Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Okay, D, we've worked it out. Today, we are going to be stretching our mouths to let the big words come right out. We're going to make a big noise with all the big boys. But before I introduce our big-time guest today.
Big time.
Our parties have all the big names, and we greet them with the widest smiles. Today, we have with us Professor Chad Briggs of the Asian Institute of Management. Chad, how you doing today, man? I'm so glad you could be here with us.
Doing great. Great. Thank you. And I did grow up in a small town.
Wait, are we covering John Cougar today? Yes. All right. So, yes, Chad contacted us probably, 4 years ago now, it seems like, emailed us and said, hey, guys, you guys should totally do war games. It was a big influence in my life. I don't know what you'd team it up with, but maybe Tron or something like that. And I was like, done. Why don't you come on and co-host
with us? Yeah, right.
And then it was months later before we actually did the episode. And then I started looking. I'm like, oh, I should look at, you know, Chad's LinkedIn profile. I'll see what he actually participates in real war games and has done it multiple times and is actually a bigwig in war games. And so my mind was kind of blown. And then since then, he has moved out to the Philippines and is a professor of disaster risk and crisis management at the Asian Institute of Management. And there's all other cool stuff that we could talk about, but we'd have to kill you because it's all top secret, and so it's very exciting.
Chad, we are so glad to have you today. Tell us, you're a big Peter Gabriel fan, correct?
I am. I was introduced to him by my best friend Eric. This is before the So album came out, so I knew his earlier solo work. Yeah, Peter Gabriel So was the first musical CD I ever owned, even before I owned a CD player. I had to borrow people's players to listen to it.
That's cool. I can name my 3 first CDs. Do you know your first CD?
No.
I had like $200 from some crappy little summer job. I bought a boombox, I bought Slippery When Wet, I bought Hysteria, and I bought Damn Yankees.
Damn Yankees is not on the wall. Yeah, we're going to get that one on the wall.
That's right. So anyway, so was your first CD. You didn't have a CD player, but you possessed the CD. So that's cool.
Yeah, I just, I really loved the music. It was something I was introduced to along with Pink Floyd, Queen, a lot of the sort of 70s and early 80s British rock, and Dire Straits as well. And I think it really influenced me a lot in terms of all the musical tastes that came after. But I always considered to be kind of the album, right? Because it wasn't just individual songs, but everything just kind of fits together as a whole, I think.
Yeah.
So we're comparing Peter Gabriel's So to Phil Collins'
No Jagger Required
to Genesis' Invisible Touch.
That's right.
All coming out within a year of each other, right?
85, 86, and 86. So yeah, that's
okay,
right.
Yeah. So all within roughly a year of each other. Now, I've got a story that I came across today, and I've mentioned this guy before in a previous episode, but I sent you a song this morning. Chad, I sent it to you, and you said, oh yes, I know that song. It's one of my favorite songs. So the song is called Intruder, which is off of Peter Gabriel's Melt album, right?
Right.
And so for those who are not familiar with Peter Gabriel's solo work, his first 4 albums are all called Peter Gabriel. And so his fans, to distinguish one Peter Gabriel from another, have given them names based on the album covers. And so the first one is Car, because it's a guy in a car. The second one is Scratch, because it's guy scratching his nails and you see the marks that are making the scratch. The third one a face is melting, so they call that one melt. And then the last one is really, it looks like kind of like fertility idol or something like that, and they call that one security. I'm not really sure why that one's security, but
the fertility idol from Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yes, from Raiders of the Lost Ark. It's that kind of weird little face on it. And anyway, so as probably everybody knows, both Peter Gabriel and Phil Collins have been the primary lead singers for the band Genesis at different times, and they played together. Peter Gabriel singing and Phil playing the drums when Genesis was in the 70s doing all of its progressive rock stuff, okay? Which I didn't know any of that Genesis stuff.
Right.
I'm a kid of the 80s. I know the 80s stuff. And so I didn't know the Genesis 70s stuff, right?
Right.
But he goes out on his own, of course, ultimately because of a riff that he's got with the band and the way things are headed. And we'll get into more detail on that later. But whenever it comes to that third album, he says, hey, you know, I've got my drummer from my last album, but I also want Phil to come and play on this album. So Phil's on about four different songs. And what he does for this album is he's creating these songs around the rhythm section. So he's getting the rhythm first, and then he's writing the song over the rhythm that's created. And so what he does is he tells, I think it's Jerry Mota was the drummer from before, and then Phil, hey guys, no cymbals or hi-hats on this album, which I don't know any drummer that would be just cool with that.
Right.
And Jerry Mota was not cool with it, but eventually came around. Phil was like, okay. And so why did he do that? Number one, the splashy cymbals kind of drown stuff out and they're distracting and he wanted to do a different sound. But number two, and this was the reason he gave, if you give an artist complete freedom, they cannot be creative. When you put restrictions on what they do, that's when they really get creative. And so he thought if he takes the cymbals away from these drummers, they're going to give him some really creative rhythms. And so they've got that as guideline number one. And then they're using a new soundboard. And the reason that I'm bringing this up is because we've talked about Hugh Padgham before, talked about him when we did the Human League on our Patreon episode. By the way, guys, if you want to hear those episodes, go to patreon.com/Hurley Podcast.
That's right.
Get to hear Human League and several other awesome one-hit wonders.
Hey, but Hugh Padgham's getting ready to be a big part of the story with Invisible Touch and No Jacket Required.
You got it. So he is doing the engineering for the Melt album, right?
Okay.
And they have a new board, and in old boards, they had to dedicate one of the lines to a microphone so that they could communicate from the booth to the guys in the studio, right? And then eventually somebody was like, that's a waste of a line, you know, and that causes problems because you got to turn the volume up and down and not record it to, you know, hi-hat track four or whatever. And so they created a dedicated microphone just for communicating between the two booths, right? And this microphone had a really, really powerful compressor, okay? And not to get too technical, but compressor just takes the really loud things and the really quiet things and pushes them together so that you've got a nice, even volume throughout stuff, right? And so as they're talking in the booth, Hugh Padgham decides, hey, I need to say something to Phil Collins, who's in there drumming. And when he hits the little button that allows the talk to go between them, you get this huge crash of a drum. And then all of a sudden it goes quiet because they've got a noise gate on it. Okay. And if you don't know what a noise gate is, it's the thing that, like, you know, if you've plugged in a microphone and you get that, you want something to knock that out, right? The subtle noises from behind, that's what the noise gate does. And so what happens is he gets this compressed, big booming sound that is all of a sudden cut off by the noise gate. And the guys in the booth are like, that sounded incredible. How can we get that sound? And he said, it's not possible. It's a separate microphone. It's not connected to the board. But that night he sits there and just keeps thinking about it and thinking about it. And he calls up the tech and he's like, look at the schematics, see if there's a way to wire that microphone, that talkback microphone that we have inside the studio, into one of our lines. And when he comes back the next day, it is accomplished. And that big, booming, loud, room-filling drum, which then immediately gets cut off to silence because of the gate, becomes the first use of the gated drum, which you can hear on Intruder, which we'll play for you now.
Wow.
Right there. Very clear that that's that created drum sound. But I think what everybody knows it from is when Phil Collins called Hugh Padgham 6 months later and said, hey, I'd like you to produce this song for me called In the Air Tonight. And that is how we get the gated drum, which is arguably one of the most influential drum sounds of 80s music.
Wow, that's a great story.
Good.
You know what?
I'm going to relax now.
Yeah, right.
You guys are in charge. That's all I have.
When you sent that to me, I listened to it, and I'm like, that sounds exactly like Frida's Something Going On, which is a Patreon episode. You've got to go check that out on our Patreon episode.
Yep.
You know who played the drums on that?
Phil Collins.
That's right. So, all right. I've got some overview stuff on the album. So, Chad, you jump in here anytime you want. I just want to talk a little bit about the overview, and then we can break down the songs. Sound cool?
Cool.
All right. So this was nominated for a Grammy for Album of the Year in 1987. It lost to, any ideas?
I wasn't following the Grammys.
Graceland by Paul Simon.
Okay. That was pretty big.
Okay.
Yeah.
Peter Gabriel has sold 16 million albums total. 7 million of that 16.
This album.
Is so.
Yeah.
Okay. This album was almost titled Good. You know, so is kind of an anti-title. He's like, they really held him to the fire and said, no, you're titling this something. And the reason he chose So, short, and it looked good, like visually.
And meaningless.
Yeah. This album was nominated for 21 Grammys. It won 6 of them. It was nominated for 3 Brit Awards, 13 MTV Music Awards. Nile Rodgers was considered to be a producer for this at one time. They settled, of course, on Daniel Lanois, who did
Joshua Tree,
yep. The Unforgettable Fire.
Yep.
Peter Gabriel has been inducted in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2010 with Genesis,
yep.
And then in 2014 as a solo artist. And this album is considered his most accessible, and I would agree with that because it's literally the only Peter Gabriel album that I am super familiar with.
Yeah, last year we did Yes and Supertramp, a couple of progressive bands that decided in the 80s, hey, or late 70s, hey, we're going to make a pop album, basically, right? Progressive
sure.
pop.
Yeah.
And Genesis started off as a progressive band, and Peter Gabriel's music has been very, if not progressive, at least leans heavily on a lot of eccentric styles. Here we are again with So, where he says, okay, I'm going to make music for the masses. Let's make some pop songs. And he knocks it out of the freaking park.
You can really understand why they were trying to be different. Because, I mean, when the band started, think of who they were playing with. I mean, these guys opened for Led Zeppelin, The Who. They're contemporaries with Jimi Hendrix. And they really sort of had to make their mark in a lot of ways. So they were a bit eccentric. And if you look at the early Genesis albums, they were really, I mean, they didn't follow the standard studio protocol, right? I mean, they take an album like Nursery Crime, first song is 10 minutes long.
Right.
You know, opens with Musical Box. And then you get other songs on the same album, which are like 8 minutes long, 7 minutes long. And later on, Genesis would still do that once in a while with, like, you know, Home by the Sea, which had its sort of 3 minute version, but then there was an extended version if you played both tracks. So they were really trying to be different. And I think that's one reason why Peter Gabriel left, was because he didn't want to be boxed in by just the studios and by the other people in the band, just trying to say, no, we need to follow a formula. We need to. And this is perhaps the time in which finally he kind of had to do that, and I think it worked. And later on, of course, he went very, very mainstream, right? He did the soundtrack for Babe and some other stuff, where he just sort of really lost his edge, you know. Not because the early stuff was really edgy.
I didn't realize this, but in between Security and So, he did the soundtrack for the movie Birdie that had Matthew Modine, yep, in it, and Nicolas Cage.
Yeah,
I listened to some of that today. It's awesome. I love it. I mean, it's obviously a soundtrack. It's not pop music. It's not progressive music, but it's very got an ambient, awesome, moving feel about it. I mean, he could have easily been one of those guys making music for all of the movies in the 80s with the style that he did on that soundtrack. Very impressive stuff.
A lot of his early songs, I mean, some people might have heard of them later because they start showing up, I think, by the 1990s or 2000s, and some TV shows like Games Without Frontiers. Biko which was off his third album, that became really iconic with the anti-apartheid movement. Actually got the album banned in South Africa. Salisbury Hill, which is my personal favorite out of all the Peter Gabriel songs. And it's really different. I mean, a lot of the Peter Gabriel stuff, the rhythm was sometimes something that would just throw you off balance a little bit. Because like Salisbury Hill, it has a 7/4 time for most of the song and only goes to 4/4 the last two verses. I think the best way of describing it was Taylor Swift did an interview where she referred to Peter Gabriel and said that he was, quote, remarkable at giving people what they want but didn't think they wanted. Right, so
That's
he
good.
could really
I
introduce
like
something
that. That's
new.
pretty
Or
good for Taylor Swift. I like that. Yeah.
no, I could also mention, and this is sort of a throwback to last year. You guys had an episode on the Miami Vice soundtrack with Morgan Richter, which was really great.
Thank
And
you. Thanks.
there were two songs. So end of the first season of Miami Vice, the Evan episode, which she spoke about at some length. That had two Peter Gabriel songs from his earlier albums. And for a lot of people, that was their first introduction. Like 1985, that was their first introduction to Peter Gabriel. And that was Rhythm of the Heat, which came off the Security album, and Biko, which came off the third album, Melt. And they were pretty iconic, but it was different, right? It was very rhythmic, it was deep, it was edgy, it just caught people in a way that people just hadn't known earlier. And then it was 1 year later when the So album came out. And then a good number of the songs, and we can go into this later, but a good number of the songs from the So album ended up being played on Miami Vice episodes.
All right, we ready to jump in track by track?
Let's jump in. First song, Red Rain. That the rhythm strikes me on this one. It is incredible and unique. I'll tell you guys, Chad suggested that we do this album, I think back close to the time that he suggested that we do War Games. And I was like, okay, I don't really know that album, but okay. I don't really, never really listened to Peter Gabriel before. Is that a good one? Is that the one with Sledgehammer on it?
Right.
Oh, yeah. So you're talking to what I would describe as basically a Peter Gabriel virgin on this. And I hear this first song and I'm like, dude, I'm in. I love it. I'm all right out of the gate. I'm like, this is great. Loving this music. I wish I had listened to it sooner.
Yeah, the reason why I think you hear that strong percussion part right there's two drummers, right? You have his normal drummer, which is Jerry Marotta, and then you also have Stuart Copeland doing the hi-hat right there
Stuart Copeland from The
from The
Police.
Police.
Yeah.
This was the second single released in the US. It was released as a promotional single. It was released to the rest of the world in 1987. This did not reach the Hot 100. Are you kidding me? This song
It didn't even hit. It
did not
didn't
hit
get
the
in the
Hot
hundred.
100. It reached
Wow.
number three on the mainstream rock charts, but did not reach the Hot 100.
Wow, that's crazy.
There's actually a third drummer because you had Manu Katché, right? French drummer, originally from the Ivory Coast, I think, who's in a number of these. This guy, whenever they recorded him, he would do his part in one take, right? I mean, he was who does that? You think of
Right.
bands nowadays, right? And they're just sort of like patching stuff together and put on autotune. Yeah, they really had some amazing percussionists in on this. And the imagery, like apparently this came from Peter Gabriel's dreams. And I would not want to be inside Peter Gabriel's heads because all the stuff I read, this guy, you know, he'd have dreams about these bottles filled with blood, or, you know, dreams about where he's at a swimming pool and he's just drinking chilled red wine. And so all this sort of red imagery, he's trying to get it out. But if you really look into the lyrics, it's a bit disturbing, but it fits with a lot of the earlier Peter Gabriel or even the earlier Genesis stuff where you're talking about. So they did a lot of mythology. Did a lot of storytelling, a lot of parables. There's a sort of Mozo character who keeps coming back into a lot of the Peter Gabriel songs, you know. So it's the sort of character who is helpless, just sort of witnesses things going on, and sort of reflected perhaps Gabriel's own mental anguish. But I guess any artist at that time was anguished in some way. But we'd mentioned before, Peter Gabriel was a serial procrastinator. So for this album, what they locked him in a hotel room and just sort of forced him to bang out some of the lyrics, and would not let the musicians near him until he had a lot of the music written down first, which, by the way, is the same approach that the editors used for Douglas Adams, the author Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, who was also a procrastinator, and they likewise locked him in a hotel room to actually pound out his books.
That's good.
That's great.
In 1985, Peter Gabriel had a kind of a minor mental breakdown, a little nervous breakdown. He also was working with Martin Scorsese about his movie, The Last Temptation of Christ.
Yep.
And so I think that maybe some of those biblical images may crop out here and there. And I think maybe in Red Rain, you have a possibility of that kind of affecting his dreams a little bit, what he's thinking about. I know for sure there's another song that was birthed out of that creative session with Martin Scorsese. I will tell you this, Chad, I'm going to double down on your Miami Vice story, right? So a lot of people associate Phil Collins as like the Mr. Miami Vice guy. And he had a lot of songs in it, and he actually starred in a couple of episodes of Miami Vice. Peter Gabriel had more songs played in Miami Vice, and I'll talk about those in depth, but this is one of them, right? So Red Rain is shown in the episode Stone War in 1986, and I went and watched the clip of what's going on in this Miami Vice episode. Think back to how cool Miami Vice was, right? You have a bad guy who clubs a lady with a telephone, like the old landline, the big clunky, wham, he clubs her. Kills her. He uses magnets to destroy a VHS tape.
Well, that's the ultimate sin you've
I
said so
mean,
far, killing bad guys, clubbing old ladies, and he used a magnet on a
used a
VHS tape.
magnet, yeah,
Outrageous.
to like
You'd have
erase
to explain to
evidence.
kids what a VHS tape is.
And he, as he's walking off, he says, "Sorry, baby, no loose ends." It was awesome, right? Why don't we have shows like Miami Vice?
Oh my gosh.
I will tell you guys this. I watched the video for Red Rain. Now, before I say this, this album has some of the most iconic, and that's not hyperbole. We'll talk about that list here in a second. Most iconic music videos of all time. The music video for Red Rain is not one of them. Okay. Apparently, they spent all their money on Sledgehammer and Big Time. This video is just him simply singing. And I texted you, I said, "You know what? Two prominent things are missing from this video." You said Peter Gabriel. I'm like, well, that's a good guess. Peter Gabriel is actually in the video. The color red is not in the video, and there's no rain in the video. Come
Yeah, I
on.
mean, like I said, you might be doing a little too literal of an interpretation needed for the video. But I will say this: given that the song's inspiration, according to Peter Gabriel, is these dreams that Chad was talking about a second ago, which literally heavily involve the color red and people-shaped wine bottles smashing after falling off of cliffs and the red wine or blood or whatever it is coming out of it, you would think that they probably would have put at least a little bit of red wet something in there.
Yeah, but you remember, I mean, this was the time when MTV was still new. There were a lot of videos where it was just band standing in a studio singing, right? And so the other videos, right? I mean, they were iconic because they were so different.
Well, I will say, Peter Gabriel said he wanted the album to crash open at the front with a great song. I think he's accomplished it. I wasn't
Absolutely.
familiar with this song before, but I absolutely love it. I think Red Rain is a top tier song on this album. I love it.
It really does draw you in. And one Peter Gabriel was really, really picky about the order of the songs. And he also wanted to make sure that, because if you listen to the album, sometimes it's not even really clear where one song ends and the next track begins. And that was deliberate, right? And was something that I think he picked up from, like, Pink Floyd did this in The Wall, Dark Side of the Moon. Because he wanted, like I said, this to be a whole. He didn't want just to have a collection of singles. But he wanted something that was an album.
I've got a great story about that. Hold that thought. Next song on the album.
Whoa, 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 whoa. You can't just go next
I
song.
can't
You
talk
can't
about it
just
till
say
we get
next
there.
song.
No,
You
no,
can't
no.
do that.
I've got a great story about the track listing. I'll get to it. Okay.
Okay. The song
Okay.
that everybody knows from this album, track number two. sledgehammer. I could listen to the whole song.
Right. It's fantastic.
I could listen to the whole song, but then, you know, YouTube would kick us off.
Right. Okay. I said something to you the other day. Chad, I'm going to share this with you. If you just look at the lyrics of this song, you would think this is an AC/DC song. Okay. Because listen
to
this.
You're saying there's some subtle innuendo in here?
This is total innuendo, right? I want to be your sledgehammer. Why don't you call my name? Oh, let me be your sledgehammer. This will be my testimony. Show me around your fruitcakes because I will be your honeybee. Uh-huh. Open up your fruitcakes where the fruit is as sweet as can be. This song is totally about sex. And I didn't know that until we started working on this podcast.
Oh my God.
I was just like, it's about sledgehammers or something.
Yeah, it was subtle. It was subtle. But of course, this is the 80s. You had to be subtle back then.
Right. This was the lead single released April of 86. Now, I've got some cool Hot 100 stuff for you guys. I got to tell you this, right? So this song reaches number one July 26th of 1986. All right? Number one, this is the song that keeps Danger Zone out of the number one spot. It never gets to number one. And that's saying something when Top Gun is everything in the summer of 86, right?
Yep.
Now, do you know the song that it knocked out of the number one spot? Okay.
Give me a chance to guess. So what was the date?
July 26th of 86. I'll give you your top six. You ready for this?
Okay, yeah.
Number six, Papa Don't Preach. Number five, Glory of Love by Peter Cetera.
Okay.
Number four, Nasty by Janet Jackson.
Okay.
Number three, the song that it knocked out of the number one spot. Number two, Danger Zone. Number one, Sledgehammer. The question is, what's the song that it knocked out of the number one spot?
86, July.
Yes, July.
Is it Bon Jovi?
Nope. That's a good guess, though.
I don't give up.
It's Invisible Touch by Genesis.
Oh.
Bit ironic.
Bill Collins said, "We weren't aware of it at the time, but if we had known he'd knocked us out of the number one spot, we would have sent him a telegram and said, congratulations, bastard."
I just got to say, what type of music would you call this? Like, it's certainly not just straight rock and roll.
It's got some pop elements. It's got some funk to it. What do you think, Chad?
It's really a mix. I mean, it even has some sort of Motown, you know, Otis Redding kind of vibe to it. They have brass sections. Right, which was kind of unusual for a Peter Gabriel song.
I mean, it's a keyboard, but that first kind of whistly sound that you get is almost like you're going through the jungle exploring some sort of lost world or something, right?
Yeah, although that part does fit with Peter Gabriel, because when he started with Genesis, he didn't play an instrument. And I guess felt bad about leaving everything up to Mike Rutherford and guys. So he learned the flute. Right. And he does play the flute once in a while. And although this was a synthesized version.
Yeah. So you mentioned that it has that kind of Motown sound. This is that comes from the bass. And they've got Tony Levin on the bass, who is an iconic bass player. And on this one, he's doing something interesting. In addition to playing a very Motown style of melody and rhythm on his bass, he's using a fretless bass, which you get the sound, like if you had a stand-up bass, that's the sound you get when you have a fretless bass. But that smooth sound that you get from a fretless bass, he's basically going against the grain because he's using a pick. And most bass players are playing with their fingers, but he's using a pick, which basically eliminates the smoothness and gives it a more punchy sound. So he's playing a Motown sound on a fretless bass with a pick, changing everything that you would expect to come from a song. And it is the backbone of the song and makes it what it is. It's just incredible.
And in the background, you've got Wayne Jackson of the Memphis Horns on trumpet, Mark Rivera on saxophone, Don Mikkelsen on trombone.
Mark Rivera is Billy Joel's guy, right?
Yeah, and you've got backing vocals like P.P. Arnold, Coral Gordon, D. Lewis. It's really quite a collection.
So this was the last song for the album, brought in at the last second. In fact, Chad, you mentioned earlier that Manu Katchi was one of the percussionists on this. He was getting in a taxi to go back to Paris. They grabbed him before he could get in the taxi and said, "Can you please come back to the studio? We got one more to do." And he's like, "I mean, I guess so, right?"
And then again, did it in a single take.
Right. And then he said, and Gabriel was like, "Hey, let's do a couple more times." He's like, "Everyone after this will be worse than that one. I'm leaving." Okay, I've got a quick story for you about the video, okay? So, obviously, one of the most iconic music videos of all time. There's
No question.
stop motion, there's claymation, there's like every nerd artist's dream in this music video. So MTV came out with a ranking of the top 100 music videos of all time. And I sent this to you.
Yeah. You said, can you name the top
Can
five?
you name the top five?
And I threw five just out of the top of my head out there. I think I said Thriller, Money for Nothing, Sledgehammer, Bad Blood, which is a Taylor Swift song, video, and
You said Take On Me.
the fifth one was Take On Me. Yes.
Okay. Take On Me was actually ranked number 19.
Right.
Chad, do you know what the top five is?
I would guess Money for Nothing was in there, just
Okay.
for his history's sake.
It is not. It is not. Which to me is blasphemy for MTV to come out with that list and not include Money for Nothing.
Crazy.
Here's your top five from MTV. Walk This Way at number five.
Wait, stop. We're talking about the Run DMC Aerosmith combo of Walk This Way.
That we covered on Raising Hell with Deaf Dave. Go back and check out that episode.
Don't get me wrong, it's not a bad video, but it is not.
You stomp in shoes without shoelaces, you're iconic. Again.
You
It's
bust
a
through
rap
the
battle
wall
with
with your,
Aerosmith.
yeah, you bust through the wall with your mic stand and then sing to an open stage. I just, no,
Okay.
that isn't number five
Number
out of
five.
all videos.
Yes. Now, do we agree that that song changed music, though?
Sure.
Okay. Number four, Sledgehammer, ranked number four all time for MTV. And according to Time Magazine, it is the number one most played video on MTV in its history. Okay. Number three, Smells Like Teen Spirit.
No. I mean, I love the song. The video is very different than anything, but they literally said the director said, I think these guys picked me because I had the worst audition reel. Like they wanted something crappy. It's kids in a gymnasium and a guy cleaning up with a mop. Like what?
It's iconic 90s, though.
No. The
And it.
song is iconic 90s. The video is just something that went along with the song.
All right. Now you ready to be really mad? Number two, Vogue by Madonna.
What? What?
Yes, Vogue.
It's
Now, I mean, if you're
black and
going to
white
pick a
and people
Madonna
doing this with
song,
their hands. What?
if you're going to pick a Madonna song, you got to pick something like Material Girl or, something really iconic from
Yes, I
earlier.
mean, even that, like Material Girl, at least you have her doing the Marilyn Monroe throwback thing. That's a video with some creativity and production value. And Vogue is a black and white close-up of models' faces and dumb dancing.
Madonna in 1990.
Not good enough to be in the top five videos of all time.
I agree. All right.
What was number one?
Number one's Thriller,
Oh, of course. All right.
right?
Well, that at
We
least
can all
makes
agree
sense.
on that.
Yeah.
Okay. Great song. Number one hit.
Love it.
Tentpole song. I got one thing.
Okay.
This was also in Miami Vice. Okay. So we're two for two on songs in Miami Vice.
Yeah.
All right.
The one other thing I could mention is that one of the production companies that helped with the stop motion was Aardman Studios, which many of you may recognize as the producers of Wallace and Gromit.
Oh, they
Yes.
did the same claymation.
Wow.
Yep.
This Oh, that's freaking
was
awesome.
their early work. This was one of their first entrees.
Wallace and
That.
Gromit.
So, if not for the Sledgehammer video, we may never have had the Were-Rabbit.
The evil penguin.
Wow, that's freaking awesome.
What about
What?
Flushed Away? I bet Flushed Away is
Yeah,
in it
no,
too.
absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, here's my little tidbit on this, and this is just because I happened to come across this a few months ago. I heard Harry Styles do a cover of this song with his band on the Howard Stern show. and they play it pretty note for note on there. It was pretty impressive. Gotta say, I actually like Peter Gabriel's voice better than Harry Styles, which I was kind of surprised about. But hey, you can't be perfect.
All right, next song on the album, song called Don't Give Up. But no one wants you when you lose. Don't give up, 'cause you have friends.
Don't give up, you're not me. This is quite a transition, right? I mean, because you go from this really upbeat staccato song to suddenly just this really, really low, kind of depressive. If you're not depressed, if you are depressed, I think it helps people out. But it's quite a change in rhythm.
So this is the third single. This is a duet with Kate Bush. And I asked you, were you familiar with Kate Bush before Stranger Things?
No.
So my kids were Kate Bush fans that one summer because of the song Running Up That Hill. This was released in October of 86. It reached number 72 on the Hot 100. Again, not super high charting. I wasn't familiar with it, but I think it's a great song. I think it's a powerful song. Elton John attributes this song to him getting sober.
Oh, wow. I mean, the idea is don't give up, right? I mean, it's like I'm miserable, you're miserable, we're all miserable, but we'll find a place that's our own, even if we don't belong in this place. Don't give up.
So apparently, Peter Gabriel used to go into some pretty deep depression.
Mm.
And this was a sort of a thing from his wife where she would just keep telling him, hey, listen, don't give up. Don't give up.
And then also inspired, he said, by depression or photographs. This was also supposedly a comment on Thatcher era kind of austerity and unemployment. But yeah, it may not have been Kate Bush, right? Because who was the first person he wanted?
Dolly Parton.
Wow, that would have been a different
what?
Song.
How about that?
Wow, that would have been a different song. Holy cow.
He invited Dolly Parton to do it. She turned him down and he turned to Kate Bush.
But he said he was really happy that Kate Bush did it because her part of the song, you know, where she comes in and just says, don't give up. She ran with that. Right. And would have been a different video too with Dolly Parton.
Oh, no doubt, right? We got to talk about the video, right?
Wait, before we get to the video,
okay.
I just want, do you guys know what the B-side on the single was?
No.
Do you know what it is, Chad? B-side on the single? Okay. Imagine I have a boombox in my hand.
In Your Eyes?
In Your Eyes was the B-side for this one.
Wow.
Wow.
That's interesting. Matthew Perry played this song at his funeral. Let me back up. Well, Matthew Perry didn't play this song.
He had it.
This song was
he
played.
He opted that it be played.
Yes.
He requested that at my funeral, let's play this song. Maybe.
There you go.
I should mention before we talk about the video, even though we talk about how so much of Peter Gabriel's songs were based on rhythm, this one was as well. So you can really hear it in the background. It's more subtle, but that sort of tom-tom pattern. And he programmed that on a drum machine, and that kind of provided the base for what he was doing. And Tony Levin played bass on this track, and apparently, like he stuck a diaper behind the strings to dampen
the sound. I love that story. I saw that as well. Just to continue on with your story, Chad. Tony Levin had a young child with him in the studio, and of course, with every time you have a young child going anywhere, you got to bring the diaper bag.
Mm-hmm.
He needed something to dampen the strings, and he looked in. I have a diaper. So he used the diaper to dampen the strings. I thought that was incredible. Willie Nelson has covered this song with Sinead O'Connor.
Mm-hmm.
Another Patreon episode of ours. Go check out Nothing Compares to You.
Yep.
And Sinead O'Connor, who was a girlfriend of Peter Gabriel's at one point.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And in fact, she even had a breakup song to talk about him called Thank You, which was very sardonic and cutting. But listen to it sometime if you can.
Okay, so let's talk about the music video for a second. The Godly and Cream version, which we've talked about, they have a hit song in 85 called Cry, which also appears in Miami Vice. But it's a 5-minute hug, like intimate hug, between Peter Gabriel and Kate Bush. And he's singing and she's singing, and it's a whole lot of just a whole lot of this.
Uh-huh.
So,
he even asked permission from his wife for being able to do that because it does look very, very intimate.
Did you see his quote on this?
No.
I love this quote. He said, "I thought 5 minutes of groping Kate Bush in front of the entire world was perhaps not the best thing for a dodgy marriage. At the time, I felt I needed a blessing." And he said, "And Jill was great."
Good call.
But yes, 5 minutes of groping Kate Bush.
Wow.
Okay, I've got a quick Miami Vice story for you on this.
Go.
All right. Keep in mind, the name of the song is Don't Give Up. The theme of the song is Don't Give Up. In Miami Vice, you have a bad guy who executes another bad guy. Then you flash over to Sonny Burnett. Do you remember Sonny Burnett? That's Sonny Crockett's deep cover alter personality, who he had some sort of accident. And so he got confused. And one of the storylines in Miami Vice was that Sonny Crockett had amnesia and thought he was Sonny Burnett, a drug dealer who actually shot Tubbs.
I love 80s television.
Yes. And so this is the episode where Sonny Crockett is coming back and taking over his memory from Sonny Burnett.
It's great. It's a great story.
Miami Vice, baby.
Bono and Alicia Keys covered this one as well on
Really?
the Oprah Winfrey Show, no less. Yeah.
Wow. Morgan Richter, she's got to love this episode.
Yeah,
right.
All right, next song on the album, That Voice Again.
This is an interesting song. There's an interesting key change that happens as he goes into the verse on this one, because it starts off with the chorus. But what do you think this song's about?
Well, I've heard him talk about sort of this idea of like the voice in your conscience kind of talking to you. But this is the song I was referring to when he met with Martin Scorsese, talking about doing the soundtrack for Last Temptation of Christ. This song was originally titled First Stone.
Okay. Yep.
And so I think that's a totally different song. I even have in my notes here that he wrote three different sets of lyrics before Daniel Lanois locked him in the barn and told him to figure it out, dude. Chad, what do you think?
I don't know. I mean, it's one of those things that, yeah, it has kind of Old Testament type references, but as with a lot of the Peter Gabriel songs, you can interpret it a lot of different ways. I mean, musically, it doesn't stand out sort of on its own. It wasn't like I don't think it was even released as a single. So it acts as kind of a bridge between songs. But, you know, he brought back the 12-string guitar, which Gabriel hadn't used since his earlier work with Genesis on Lamb Lies Down on Broadway. So it was a long time ago. And you have Manu Katché on drums again, Tony Levin on bass. You have violin, I think it's El Shankar. And I really like it. But like I said, it sort of fits with the album. It's not like something that I would just sort of go to Spotify and say, oh, I want to listen to this song just on
Right.
its own.
The lyrics paint this picture of a desire to have a close and meaningful relationship with someone, but then that there's a voice in your head that's judging them on some other criteria, which makes you unhappy with them, right?
Does that fit Mary Magdalene and Jesus?
Could be that. It could be anybody's relationship with Jesus or whatever deity you want, where you're
Sure.
like, hey, I want to have that faith, but I've got these doubts. Or it could be, you know, he's in a difficult stage of his marriage and he wants to be happy with his wife, but then he keeps thinking about all of the crap she's done in the past and he's mad at her and he can't get that out of his head in order to have a good time with her. And so there's any number of relationships that you could put these words around.
Well, yeah, I mean, I didn't grow up religious. I was just a what kid in junior high when this song came out. So for me, it was just kind of the tempestuous or, you know, rough and tumble of just being a teenager, and you want to be close, but you're afraid. And so yeah, it could really fit anyway.
All right.
Hit stop on your tape player, kick it out, flip it over for side two, and we start off with.
Sorry, here. Hold
Well,
on.
wait a minute. Here's my story.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
If you're talking about the CD, it's a different song than the vinyl.
Okay.
They changed the song order. So for our purposes, we're going to do In Your Eyes. But if you have the CD, In Your Eyes is the last track on the album.
Correct.
On the vinyl, In Your Eyes is the first song on side two. And I'll tell you why here in just a second.
Okay. You're screwing with Chad's nostalgia here, because he has told us this is the first CD that he had. And so he was ready for Mercy Street, and you threw eyes at him.
Really?
In my notes, Mercy Street's right here.
Well, let's do that.
Messing with me, D.
No, okay. So all right. So if it's a tape, I don't know what happened on the tape. You've just told me about the vinyl and the CD.
I think it was true on the tape as well, because it was an issue of time, you know, what they could fit.
Okay, so on the tape and on the CD in 1986, In Your Eyes is what's next, right?
That's correct.
Then we should be doing In Your Eyes. Okay, so the vote has been taken. We are not doing Mercy Street. We are doing In Your Eyes, because
you guys are killing me.
This is an 80s podcast, dadgummit. So Let It Be Written, So Let It Be Done.
That's right.
First song, second side, In Your Eyes.
All my instincts, they return. The grand facade so soon will burn. Without a noise, without my pride, I reach out from the inside.
Gosh, what an amazingly moving song.
Yeah.
Like, just hits you where it hurts.
This song is incredible, but I did not know it until 1989 when I saw the movie Say Anything.
Mm-hmm.
In your eyes, the light, the heat.
By the way, I just did a podcast with Dayton Johnson, Amber Lewis, the DocuBay 77 podcast. We talk about Say Anything, and this song is 80s iconic because you have John Cusack holding the boombox over his head to try to woo back Ione Skye's character, playing this beautiful Peter Gabriel song. I just absolutely love it. Chad, what do you think?
It's great, and it throws back to Peter Gabriel's earlier work, right? Because it has this African influence, and that goes back to the song I mentioned earlier, Biko, which was on his third album. On the fourth album, there was Rhythm of the Heat, which was also in the same Miami Vice episode, and also had a lot of African beat. This is where I think it really got put together. And to have Youssou N'Dour with these sorts of African vocals, where he's singing in Wolof.
That's right.
It's really something.
So this was the second single released August of 86 in the U.S. It reached number one on the U.S. Billboard mainstream rock charts, only hit number 26 on the Hot 100 in November of 86, but it also nearly cracked the top 40 in 89 after the release of Say Anything. It reached number 41 on the Hot 100. The urban legend is that this song is written about Rosanna Arquette. This is now officially the second song we've talked about written about Rosanna Arquette.
What was the name of the first one?
Oh, that'd be Rosanna.
Oh, all right.
Go back to our Toto 4 episode we did a couple of years ago. Now, here's the interesting thing about this. Cameron Crowe, who is the director of Say Anything and the writer.
Yeah, Cameron Crowe has come up like three times in the last four episodes.
He's also married to Nancy Wilson at this time of Heart.
Right.
Which, go back to our Heart episode. So he contacts Peter Gabriel and asks him, hey, I need this song for this iconic moment. The guy's holding his boombox over his head. Right now we've got Billy Idol's To Be a Lover plugged in there. We don't think that fits very well.
No.
I want to use In Your Eyes. So Peter Gabriel says, well, send me over the movie and I'll watch it. So Cameron Crowe contacts the studio, say, hey, send him an early cut of the movie. So they send it over. He agrees to let the song go in the movie, but he contacts Cameron Crowe and he says, listen, I'm okay with the song being in the movie. I'm just a little bit concerned about the lead character dying of an overdose. I don't think that's very cool. And Cameron Crowe's like, well, dude, what movie did you watch? Because that's not Say Anything. Come to find out, the studio had accidentally sent over Wired, which is a John Belushi biographical picture. Also a Cameron Crowe movie.
Okay.
So Peter Gabriel agreed for the song to be in the movie. It was just the wrong movie.
Okay. Well, now that story it just causes me pause because now I know that when John Cusack is holding that boombox up as the actor,
yeah,
he's not hearing Peter
Gabriel. No, he's not hearing that.
And Ione Sky is not hearing it either.
In fact, he's not even looking at Ione Sky. He's facing a gas station.
I mean, that I can understand, but Jiminy, you don't even... Wow, that song is such an integral part of that iconic scene, and neither one of the actors were actually listening to the song as it was being played.
That's right. That's right.
Well, didn't you guys years ago talk about Saturday Night Fever and how John Travolta was not actually dancing to the Bee Gees?
That is correct.
That's right.
Yep.
You want the story on why this song on the tape and on the record was in the number one spot on side two instead of at the end?
Yes, please tell me.
Have you ever heard of an album like switching its lineup like years after it's been released?
Not many.
You're right. Okay, so here's the deal. I'm going to read this because I want to get this right. When determining the track order for So, Gabriel wanted In Your Eyes to be the final track. That's what Chad just said. But its prominent bass line meant that it had to be placed earlier in the vinyl edition where the phonograph stylus had more room to vibrate. This restriction was no longer an issue later for later CD releases, and the track was placed at the end of the album.
Okay. So the nature of vinyl is the closer you get to the middle, the tighter the circles are. Tighter the circles are, the more difficult it is to fully realize the bass sounds.
Boom.
Crazy stuff that nobody cares about anymore because we haven't been making vinyl records for a long dang time now.
This song is amazing. It's romantic. I love it. Chad, do you love the movie Say Anything?
I do. I do. Although I remember driving to watch it by myself in the summer of 1989. It's like a month before I left for Norway as an exchange student. It just has all this sort of romanticism about it. This was never released as a single in the UK. That really kind of surprised me. But I think it came out, like you said, Dee, it came out later, right? People didn't know about it quite as much until the movie.
Yeah.
We've got to touch a little bit of history on here, right?
Sure.
So we've talked about the fact that, I mean, these songs are difficult to classify. He has a unique sound. He, I think Chad can identify with this to some degree, traveled the world as a younger man. And because he loves the music of all these different parts of the world, that is what has influenced his music. He's got more world music involved in his stuff, including the rhythms on a lot of these songs. And he recorded this at his own studio, which was called the Real World Studio. But I was just thinking to myself, if I hear Billy Gibbons' guitar, it doesn't matter what album it's on. I'm going to, in one, two notes, I'm going to go, that's Billy Gibbons' guitar. But Peter Gabriel is constantly trying to find not only new sounds as far as different cultures go, but in the studio, he was the guy who was at the forefront of technology because his dad was an electrical engineer and an inventor. And so he was one of the first guys to have a Fairlight. He was one of the first guys to have a sampler. He was one of the first guys to use a programmable drum machine. And he's always been on that kind of cutting edge of technology. But he takes that technology, and then combines it with music of cultures that are literally millennia old, because he's pulling from different things. And it's this beautiful blend of real grounded analog music combined with the technology cutting edge of whatever's going on in the day that gives Peter Gabriel that unique sound on every single album that he does.
Yeah. And if you go back to a song like Biko, and in the background, there are synthetic bagpipes playing. And like, who the hell would think of that, right? I mean, who'd think, oh, you know what would really fit with this African music right now? If we put in some electronic bagpipes. So In Your Eyes is really, I think, it's a more commercial culmination of that, but it really, really works. And for anyone listening, go to YouTube and look up The Secret World Live. So at that concert series, this was the last song he would play. And they would play an 11-minute version of this song. It would still have all of the Yusuf Nador vocals, but it was like Gabriel and Nador singing to each other. It's really something to listen to.
That's awesome.
I got one more thing for you. in 2012, as he was beginning to play this song in the Hollywood Bowl, John Cusack walked up on stage with a boombox, held it up over his head briefly, and took off. And you know who's in the crowd that night? Cameron Crowe.
Nice.
And he tweeted out something like, Cusack, Gabriel on stage, nothing better than that.
That's fantastic. Yep. Oh, by the way, go check out our last two episodes, One Crazy Summer versus Better Off Dead, John Cusack's double feature.
That's it.
Okay.
Next song. Next song on the album is called Mercy Street.
Looking down on empty streets, all she can see are the dreams all made solid, are the dreams made real. All of the buildings, all of the cars were once just a dream in somebody's head. She pictures the broken.
Let me just sidetrack with you just real quick. Fun drinking game for this episode might be to take a drink every time Jason says the word so.
So this is based on the works of American poet Anne Sexton, who would write as a way of therapy. She was a mental patient. She struggled. She attempted suicide four times, and then on the fifth time she was successful.
Oh.
But this is based off an experience where Peter Gabriel, who had toured the world, had gained all these points and had a free airline trip, and he was going to take a vacation to Rio. But the catch was he had to sit coach. I thought that was interesting, right? In order to cash this in, he had to sit coach. Right? Excuse me, could you pass the peanuts, Peter Gabriel? But on that plane to Rio is Verdon White of Earth, Wind, and Fire. Mm-hmm. Okay? They exchanged some pleasantries, whatever. The plane got up. It's over the ocean, and in the middle of the flight, the plane starts to experience some trouble. So they got to dump some fuel in the middle of the ocean. There's no land in sight. It's kind of a hairy deal. And Verdon White comes up to him and puts his hand on his shoulder and says, pray with me, brother. Everything turned out okay, but this song is sort of birthed out of that crazy, weird experience.
Wow.
Chad, you got anything on this song?
Well, yeah, because a lot of the, you know, the initial working title was what, Foro? Because he used that trip not just as the inspiration, but they used Brazilian percussion, which is sort of integral to it. The lyrics are very obviously poetic, and he used the percussionist Djalma Correa. This was the only part, I think, of this album that was recorded outside of the studios. I know there was some post-production done in New York, but most of it was done in the UK, except for this part where they did some of it in Rio.
I think we're going to have a chat on for every episode where we have to pronounce somebody's name who's not from the US.
I noticed that too, yeah. This song was also used in Miami Vice. I watched the clip. I don't know exactly what's going on, but I'll tell you what I know. There was a guy killed on the Hi-Li court. Crockett's driving his white Testarossa. And then some beautiful babe steps out of the shadows and says, take him outside and kill him. Mercy Street, Miami Vice.
Okay.
There you go.
All right.
All right. Can we get to the best song in the album, please?
Whoa, really?
Yes.
Are you spiking the football?
I spiked the football. Yes.
Holy cow. Boys and girls, ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Colvin's calling it best song on the album, in his opinion.
This song is called Big Time. Okay.
So you like this?
I freaking love it. This
you really,
is a
really like it?
Dead bullseye for me. Yes.
Is he making it grow?
This song is big time. Okay. He's making it grow for me. Yeah. This is
I relate to the song. You know, like I said, I came from a small town. People thought so small, they use small words, but.
But not you. You were smarter than that, right?
I worked it out.
Yeah. This is the fourth single released October of 86. This reaches number 8 on the Hot 100 in March of 87, okay? Listen to this top 10, okay? Number 8 is Big Time. And I'm like, what could possibly be better than that song? That's so good. It's so funky. It's that pop fun. And the video is amazing. Well, let's just see what we got here. All right.
All right.
Number 7, Fight for Your Right to Party by the Beastie Boys. 80s iconic, right?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Number 6, Keep Your Hands to Yourself, Georgia Satellites.
That was a big one. That
pretty good song, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Number 5, Respect Yourself by Bruce Willis.
Wow.
Bruce Willis with a top 10 hit.
Wow.
Okay. Number 4, Somewhere Out There by Linda Ronstadt and Aaron Neville, I think. It's the Fievel song.
Yeah, from American Tale.
Yep. Yep. Number 3, You've Got It All by the Jets.
Go back to our Patreon page. That's a Patreon episode right there.
That is, yep. Number 2, Jacob's Ladder by Huey Lewis and the News.
Okay, yep.
And number 1, Living on a Prayer by Bon Jovi.
Well,
that's a stacked top 8 right
there.
It is.
I mean, it's a beautiful thing, the 1980s.
Yes.
The amazing music that you had all coming out at the same time that sounded oh so different. Like none of those songs sound the same.
Yeah, and they're all awesome.
Yeah.
Tell us the story about the Funk Fingers. Did you watch that video I sent you?
Yeah, I sent it to you. No, you sent it to me. You did send it.
I sent it to you.
Did you send it to me?
Yes.
Okay, then you sent it to me.
Okay.
I you know what? I guess after you sent it, I sent it out to like 3 other people because I was so like, what the heck? Okay.
Is this the bit with Tony Levin and Jerry Marotta?
Yes.
Yeah. So Tony Levin's playing the bass. Peter Gabriel wants a different sound. And I don't remember whose idea it is, but the idea is Jerry is going to play Tony's bass strings with his drumsticks.
Right.
Right. And so I've got the camera here. He's doing the fingering with his left hand as you do. And Jerry's over here pounding away on the strings with the drums. But then what are you going to do when you perform the song live? Right. I mean, somebody's got to be. Who's going to be the drummer that comes up and kneels down in front of Tony Levin's crotch during the live performance? So they didn't do that. They invented a thing. I mean, if you've seen Everything Everywhere All at Once and they have the hot dog hands, that's exactly what this looks like, except 2 fingers. And with 2 fingers, he's got 2 large extension pieces that he goes, ba-doom, 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 ba-doom. I'm playing the bass with my 2 fingers, smacking them with the drumstick.
Funk fingers.
The funk fingers. Yeah. And I've had funk fingers before. Her name was.
The bass line in this song is so awesome. And I think you can attribute it to the Funk Fingers, you know?
For sure, yeah.
It's such a difference from, I mean, you go from Mercy Street into Big Time. The album takes you on a roller coaster. I think that's one of the great things about it. But Big Time is a song that just stands by itself. Not just for the video, which like Sledgehammer was iconic, but like you said, the bass line, the drum. So it wasn't just Jerry Marotta. You had Manu Katché again. Stuart Copeland came back. You had other people like Simon Clark and on organ and bass, Wayne Jackson on trumpet, Mark Rivera on saxophone, Don Mickelson on trombone. I mean, you had so much into this, and it's just kind of a fun song, right? It's kind of a pick your up. So if you're really depressed, go listen to Don't Give Up. But if you already just want something to wake you up in the morning, you know, Big Time is a great to sort of get you going.
Absolutely. So this song's about like ambition and like getting out there, making it happen, going from a small town to the big town and making a big noise with the big boys and onward and upward. And my question is, why was this song not in the movie Secret of My Success? Is that a dead on perfect song for that movie?
Wow. That's a deep dive on a Michael J. Fox trivia episode.
I love Secret of My Success.
I haven't heard anyone else reference that movie in so many years.
Yes.
So just what is this song about other than moving out of the small time and moving into the big time? He keeps talking about watching it grow. Yeah. And I'm going to play this little bit, and it's in between where he says, and my, and then when he goes, and my bank account, in between that. I want you guys to listen to this.
Big time.
My what's getting bigger?
His willy?
It sounds like his penis. I swear I'm listening to that. I'm like, did he just say my penis is getting bigger? I had to look at the lyrics, and it's my belly's getting bigger. It's pretty close. I was like, what? You can't put that in a 1986 song.
His belly's getting bigger?
His belly. Yeah.
Once again, AC/DC.
I just love the reference to how he needed such a big pillow for his big head.
For his big fat head, right? Yeah.
Going to cry himself to sleep on his gigantic pillow.
All right. I hate to leave this one. We got to get going. Cute.
Yeah.
Next song on the album is called We Do What We're Told.
Okay, so this is basically an instrumental with some of the barest, simplest,
just kind of a
basic lyrics ever.
Yeah.
What do you think of this song?
It's kind of a bridge, but it fits with some of the stuff he'd done before. I mean, earlier songs like Exposure, which is essentially Peter Gabriel saying the same word over and over and over again. But this one, interestingly, did show up twice on Miami Vice, both in season 3 and in season 4.
So I watched the clip. You want to know what's going on in Miami Vice? I will tell you. It's amazing.
Hit me.
Okay. So Crockett and Tubbs are meeting a guy getting out of jail, and clearly Crockett has gone to bat for this guy. He thinks he's falsely accused or whatever, and then he realizes through this conversation that the guy was actually guilty and that he was playing Crockett the whole time, and Don Johnson's face is just stunned that this guy played him.
Okay.
And the quote is, I won't be needing this anymore, and he takes the crucifix off his neck and is like, I've got a question for you, Chad. Do you know why it says, why this title is We Do What We're Told, Milgram's 37? Do you know about that?
Yeah, referring to the Milgram experiment from Yale University. So this was based on, Milgram was a psychologist and wrote a book, Obedience to Authority, an Experimental View. And many of you may have heard of this. This is the idea that if you put someone in a lab coat with a clipboard and you tell people to give electric shocks to someone, they will do it. Yeah. I mean, a lot of people will just submit to authority, even if they know that the person is being harmed and they have no good reason for doing so. All right. So this influenced a lot of psychology work on hierarchy, on some peer pressure, on authority figures. And this actually fit with, I studied this in political psychology when I was an undergrad, because I was studying some pretty deep stuff about psychology of genocide. I mean, this is the early 90s. So even though we did historical work, you know, my second year living abroad was in Hungary in 1993. And just south of that, there was a pretty nasty little war going on in Bosnia-Herzegovina. And this was pretty central. So I didn't know about Milgram, okay, in 1986 when this came out. I was a nerd, but I wasn't that big a nerd. but definitely knew about it, by the early 90s. So it's pretty deep stuff and pretty dark. But then again, so is a lot of Peter Gabriel stuff.
This idea stems from the Nazi German soldiers who just said they were following orders. It also kind of stems from some of the stuff that went on with American soldiers in Vietnam. But just to give the details of the experiment, the subjects of the experiment, not realizing that they were the subjects, thinking that they were the people that were helping out the lab coat guys, would turn a dial and there would be someone else on the other side that the person turning the dial was told was receiving electric shock. And as it turns out, they weren't. They were just actors, but they would be screaming like, stop, don't do this anymore. I can't take it anymore. And the participants would go, I really don't know that I should do this. And the guy in the lab coat would say, it's fine. Just keep going. Just turn it up a little bit more. And some of them would start laughing awkwardly because they didn't, it was just so weird, but they would still turn the dial because someone in authority told them what to do. We do what we're told.
There will always be a certain number of people who would refuse. They would, you know, for moral reasons, they would do what was right. refuse to submit to authority, but a lot of people would go along with it. And there were a certain number of people, like you said, who actually seemed to enjoy it, get into it, had this sort of sadistic streak. And that was really, really disturbing. And not to get too personal, but I was doing work on bystander psychology, right? So why do people enable others to let things happen, bad things happen to other people? And eventually when I was living in Hungary, it got so real, like I just understood it, that I wanted to get out of doing security work entirely. And that's when I started doing environmental work. And eventually the two kind of coincided. So I do both now. 9/11 also kind of threw me back into it, but it's, yeah, this song, it may not sound like very much, but to me, it sends me back both to the 1980s, but also to the 1990s, and reminds me of a lot of pretty, pretty emotional stuff. So, you know, when you talk about songs sometimes and certain things which people might just skip over it, it's a short song, they may not even remember it so much, but, you know, there are certain songs that just sort of, you know, are iconic in their own way in terms of personal growth and what they mean for you in your life.
Okay, last song on the album. This song is called...
Your album.
Last song on my album is called This Is the Picture, in parentheses, Excellent Birds.
Flying birds. Excellent birds. Watch them fly.
There they go.
Okay, this is the only song on the album. I'm like, what the F is this? I have no use for this song at all. I don't. Excellent birds. What? This song does nothing for me. Chad, what do you think?
Well, I understood it wasn't even included in the original vinyl release. So it was sort of added on the cassette and CD versions. It definitely would not work for me as the final song, right? Which is why I was glad I always had the CD version, and In Your Eyes was the last.
Right.
So in that sense, this was just a bridge, right? This was a bridge between different songs. And so it sort of leads into the final, you know, In Your Eyes. That doesn't really stand out on its own. Certainly would never survive as a single.
Yeah. I can see it much more as in Peter Gabriel's vision of, this is the song that leads into In Your Eyes, which was a great closing song.
Fantastic closing closer. Song. Yeah.
And so then to take that great closer and throw it, you know, four songs back, it leaves you with a bridge to nowhere, if you will.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
I almost feel like we need to talk about In Your Eyes again, just to kind of like close it out and stamp this album as incredible. I'm having a blast covering this trinity of Genesis.
Trinity yeah. of Genesis. Yes. How biblical of us. So guys, thank you so much for joining us. Chad, thank you so much for coming back again. It was great to see you. It is always wonderful to get your insight into these things. And I guess we'll be back next week.
That's right. Thanks, Chad. And to everybody out there, we will see you back here next week.
Thank you, guys.
Excuse me. Our potty, dang it.